at 7:30 p.m. Hump has been serving up hot, heavy, and hilarious dirty film shorts to the masses for two whole decades, and we're kicking off this milestone year with the first of two all-new lineups for 2025. The mission of Hump is to create a public space for sex positivity, representation, and inclusivity, which, given our modern circumstances, is more important than ever. These are films made by real people for real people. More information at BarrymoreLive.com. The Barrymore Theater presents Dan Savage's Hump Film Fest, 20 years and going hard, Saturday, April 19th at 7:30 p.m. You are listening to WORT Madison.
Listen to my voice. My voice will help you and guide you still deeper into Europa. Every time you hear my voice, with every word and every number, you will enter a still deeper layer, open, relaxed, and receptive. I shall now count from 1 to 10. On the count of 10, you will be in Europa. I say 1. And as you focus your attention entirely on my voice, you will slowly begin to relax. 2. Your hands and your fingers are getting warmer and heavier. 3. The warmth is spreading through your arms, to your shoulders and your neck. 4. Your feet and your legs get heavier. 5. The warmth is spreading to the whole of your body. on six, I want you to go deeper. I say six, and the whole of your relaxed body is slowly beginning to sink. Seven, you go deeper and deeper and deeper. Eight, on every breath you take, you go deeper. Nine, you are floating. On the mental count of 10, you will be in Europa. Be there at 10. I say 10. You are listening to the noise of rain beating against a large metal drum. Go closer. There's a fence, and you have to stop. You are walking across the rail yard, and you've been traveling by train from Bremerhaven, and before that, on a ship from New York. You are in Germany. The year is 1945.
You are in North America. The year is 2025. And you're tuned to Fiction Jones on WORT. This is our book reading hour, and we're beginning a new book tonight. David Lindsay's visionary science fiction novel from 1920, A Voyage to Arcturus. Stay tuned. Voyage to Arcturus by David Lindsay. 1. The Seance. On a March evening at 8 o'clock, Backhouse, the medium, a fast-rising star in the psychic world, was ushered into the study of Prolens, the Hampstead residence of Montague Fowl. The room was illuminated only by the light of a blazing fire. The host, eyeing him with indolent curiosity, got up, and the usual conventional greetings were exchanged. Having indicated an easy chair before the fire to his guest, the South American merchant sank back again into his own. The electric light was switched on. Fall's prominent, clear-cut features, metallic-looking skin, and general air of bored impassiveness did not seem greatly to impress the medium, who was accustomed to regard men from a special angle. Backhouse, on the contrary, was a novelty to the merchant. As he tranquilly studied him through half-closed lids and the smoke of a cigar, he wondered how this little, thick-set person with the pointed beard contrived to remain so fresh and sane in appearance in view of the morbid nature of his occupation. Do you smoke? Drawled Fall, by way of starting the conversation. No? Then will you take a drink? Not at present, thank you. A pause. Everything is satisfactory. The materialization will take place. I see no reason to doubt it. That's good, for I would not like my guests to be disappointed. I have your check written out in my pocket. Afterward will do quite well. 9 o'clock was the time specified, I believe. I fancy so. The conversation continued to flag. Fall sprawled in his chair and remained apathetic. Would you care to hear what arrangements I've made? I am unaware that any are necessary, beyond chairs for your guests. I mean, the decoration of the seance room, the music, and so forth. Backhouse stared at his host. But this is not a theatrical performance. Well, that's correct. Perhaps I ought to explain. There will be ladies present, and ladies, you know, they're aesthetically inclined. They have expectations. In that case, I have no objection. I only hope they will enjoy the performance to the end. He spoke rather dryly. Well, that's all right then, said Fall. Flicking his cigar into the fire, he got up and helped himself to whiskey. Will you come and see the room? Thank you, no. I prefer to have nothing to do with it until the time arrives. Then let's go see my sister, Mrs. Jameson, who is in the drawing room. She sometimes does me the kindness to act as my hostess, as I am unmarried. I will be delighted, said Backhouse coldly. They found the lady alone, sitting by the open pianoforte in a pensive attitude. She had been playing Scriabin and was overcome. The medium took in her small, tight, patrician features and porcelain-like hands, and wondered how Fall came by such a sister. She received him bravely, with just a shade of quiet emotion. He was used to such receptions at the hands of the sex, and knew well how to respond to them. "What amazes me," she half whispered, after 10 minutes of graceful, hollow conversation, "is, if you must know, not so much the manifestation itself, though that will surely be wonderful, as your assurance that it will take place. Tell me the grounds of your confidence." "I dream with open eyes," he answered, looking around at the door. "And others see my dreams. That is all." But that's wonderful," responded Mrs. Jameson. She smiled rather absently, for the first guest had just entered. It was Kent Smith, the ex-magistrate, celebrated for his shrewd judicial humor, which, however, he had the good sense not to attempt to carry into private life. Although well on the wrong side of 70, his eyes were still disconcertingly bright. With the selective skill of an old man, he immediately settled himself in the most comfortable of many comfortable chairs. "So we are to see wonders tonight." "Fresh material for your autobiography," remarked Fall. "Oh, you should not have mentioned my unfortunate book. An old public servant is merely amusing himself in his retirement, Mr. Backhouse. You have no cause for alarm. I have studied in the School of Discretion." "I'm not alarmed. There can be no possible objection to your publishing whatever you please." "You are most kind," said the old man, with a cunning smile. "Trent is not coming tonight," remarked Mrs. Jameson, throwing a curious little glance at her brother. "I never thought he would. It's not in his line." "Mrs. Trent, you must understand," she went on, addressing the ex-magistrate, "has placed us all under a debt of gratitude. She has decorated the old lounge hall upstairs most beautifully and has secured the services of the sweetest little orchestra."
"But this is Roman magnificence."
"Backhouse thinks the spirit should be treated with more deference," laughed Fall. "Surely, Mr. Backhouse, a poetic environment—" "Pardon me. I'm a simple man, and I always prefer to reduce things to elemental simplicity. I raise no opposition, but I express my opinion. Nature is one thing, and art is another. And I am not sure that I don't agree with you, said the ex-magistrate. An occasion like this ought to be simple, to guard against the possibility of deception, if you will forgive my bluntness, Mr. Backhouse. We shall sit in full light, replied Backhouse, and every opportunity will be given to all to inspect the room. I shall also ask you to submit me to a personal examination. A rather embarrassed silence followed. It was broken by the arrival of two more guests who entered together. These were Pryor, the prosperous city coffee importer, and Lang, the stock jobber, well known in his own circle as an amateur prestidigitator. Backhouse was slightly acquainted with the latter. Pryor, perfuming the room with the faint odor of wine and tobacco smoke, tried to introduce an atmosphere of joviality into the proceedings. Finding that no one seconded his efforts, however, he shortly subsided and fell to examining the watercolors on the walls. Lang, tall, thin, growing bald, said little, but stared at Backhouse a good deal. Coffee, liqueurs, and cigarettes were now brought in. Everyone partook, except Lang and the medium. At the same moment, Professor Halbert was announced. He was the eminent psychologist, the author and lecturer on crime, insanity, genius, and so forth, considered in their mental aspects. His presence at such a gathering somewhat mystified the other guests, but all felt that, as if the object of their meeting had immediately acquired additional solemnity. He was small, meager-looking, and mild in manner, but was probably the most stubborn-brained of all that mixed company. Completely ignoring the medium, he at once sat down beside Kent Smith, with whom he began to exchange remarks. At a few minutes past the appointed hour, Mrs. Trent entered, unannounced. She was a woman of about 28. She had a white, demure, saint-like face, smooth black hair, and lips so crimson and full that they seemed to be bursting with blood. Her tall, graceful body was most expensively attired. Kisses were exchanged between her and Mrs. Jameson. She bowed to the rest of the assembly and stole a half glance and a smile at Fall. The latter gave her a queer look, and Backhouse, who lost nothing, saw the concealed barbarian in the complacent gleam of his eye. She refused the refreshment that was offered her, and Fall proposed that, as everyone had now arrived, they should adjourn to the lounge hall. Mrs. Trent held up a slender palm. Did you or did you not give me carte blanche, Montague? Of course I did, said Fall, laughing. But what's the matter? Perhaps I've been rather presumptuous. I don't know. I have invited a couple of friends to join us. No one knows them. The two most extraordinary individuals you ever saw. And mediums, I am sure. It sounds very mysterious. Who are these conspirators? At least tell us their names, you provoking girl, put in Mrs. Jameson. One rejoices in the name of Moskal, and the other in that of Nightspore. That's nearly all that I know about them, so don't overwhelm me with any of your more questions. But where did you pick them up? You must have picked them up somewhere. But this is a cross-examination. Have I sinned against convention? I swear I'll tell you not another word about them. They will be here directly, and then I will deliver them to your tender mercy. I don't know them, said Fall, and nobody else seems to. But of course, we will all be very pleased to have them. Shall we wait or what? I said 9. It's past that now. It's quite possible that they may not turn up after all. Anyway, don't wait. I would prefer to start at once, said Backhouse. The lounge, a lofty room, 40 feet long by 20 wide, had been divided for the occasion into 2 equal parts by a heavy brocade curtain drawn across the middle. The far end was thus concealed. The near half had been converted into an auditorium by a crescent of armchairs. There was no other furniture. A large fire was burning halfway along the wall between the chair backs and the door. The room was brilliantly lighted by electric bracket lamps. A sumptuous carpet covered the floor. Having settled his guests in their seats, Fall stepped up to the curtain and flung it aside. A replica, or nearly so, of the Drury Lane presentation of the temple scene in The Magic Flute was then exposed to view. The gloomy, massive architecture of the interior. The glowing sky above it in the background, and silhouetted against the ladder, the gigantic seated statue of the pharaoh. A fantastically carved wooden couch lay before the pedestal of the statue. Near the curtain, obliquely placed the auditorium, was a plain oak armchair for the use of the medium. Many of those present felt privately that the setting was quite inappropriate to the occasion and savored rather unpleasantly of ostentation. Backhouse in particular seemed put out. The usual compliments, however, were showered on Mrs. Trent as the deviser of so remarkable a theater. Fall invited his friends to step forward and examine the apartment as minutely as they might desire. Pryor and Lang were the only ones to accept. The former wandered about among the pasteboard scenery, whistling to himself, occasionally tapping a part of it with his knuckles. Lang, who was in his element, ignored the rest of his party and commenced a patient, systematic search, on his own account, for secret apparatus. Fall and Mrs. Trent stood in a corner of the temple, pretending to hold Backhouse in conversation, watch them as only a deeply interested woman knows how to watch. Lang, to his own disgust, having failed to find anything of a suspicious nature, the medium now requested that his own clothing should be searched. All these precautions are quite needless and beside the matter in hand, as you will immediately see for yourselves. My reputation demands, however, that other people who are not present would not be able to say afterwards that trickery had been resorted to. To Lang again fell the ungrateful task of investigating pockets and sleeves. Within a few minutes he expressed himself satisfied, and nothing mechanical was in Backhouse's possession. The guests reseated themselves. Fall ordered 2 more chairs to be brought for Mrs. Trent's friends, who, however, had not yet arrived. He then pressed an electric bell and took his own seat. The signal was for the hidden orchestra to begin playing. A murmur of surprise passed through the audience as, without previous warning, the beautiful and solemn strains of Mozart's temple music pulsated through the air. The expectation of everyone was raised, while beneath her pallor and composure, it could be seen that Mrs. Trent was deeply moved. It was evident that, aesthetically, she was by far the most important person present. Fall watched her, with his face sunk on his chest, sprawled as usual. Backhouse stood up with one hand on the back of his chair and began speaking. The music instantly sank to pianissimo and remained for as long as he was on his legs. Ladies and gentlemen, you are about to witness a materialization. That means you will see something appear in space that was not previously there. At first, it will appear as a vaporous form, but finally it will be a solid body, which anyone present may feel and handle and, for example, shake hands with. For this body will be in a human shape. It will be a real man or woman, which I can't say, but a man or woman without known antecedents. If, however, you demand from me an explanation of the origin of this materialized form, where it comes from, whence the atoms and molecules composing its tissues are derived, I am unable to satisfy you. I am about to produce the phenomenon. If anyone can explain it to me afterward, I shall be very grateful. That is all I have to say. He resumed his seat, half turning his back on the assembly, and paused for a moment before beginning his task. It was precisely at this minute that the manservant opened the door and announced in a subdued but distinct voice, "Mr. Maskol, Mr. Knightspor." Everyone turned round. Fall rose to welcome the late arrivals. Backhouse also stood up and stared hard at them. The two strangers remained standing by the door, which was closed quietly behind them. They seemed to be waiting for the mild sensation caused by their appearance to subside before advancing into the room. Maskol was a kind of giant, but of broader and more robust physique than most giants. He wore a full beard. His features were thick and heavy, coarsely modeled, like those of a wooden carving. But his eyes, small and black, sparkled with the fires of intelligence and audacity. His hair was short, black, and bristling. Knightspor was of middle height, but so tough-looking that he appeared to be trained out of all human frailties and susceptibilities. His hairless face seemed consumed by an intense spiritual hunger, and his eyes were wild and distant. Both men were dressed in tweeds. Before any words were spoken, a loud and terrible crash of falling masonry caused the assembly party to start up from their chairs in consternation. It sounded as if the entire upper part of the building had collapsed. Fall sprang to the door and called to the manservant to say what was happening. The man had to be questioned twice before he gathered what was required of him. He said he had heard nothing. In obedience to his master's order, he went upstairs. Nothing, however, was amiss there. Neither had the maids heard anything. In the meantime, Backhouse, who almost alone of those assembled had preserved his savoir-faire, went straight up to Nightspore, who stood gnawing his nails. "Perhaps you can explain it, sir?" "It was supernatural," said Nightspore in a harsh, muffled voice, turning away from his questioner. "I guessed so. It is so familiar a phenomenon, but I have never heard it so loud." He then went among the guests, reassuring them. By degrees, they settled down, but it was observable that their former easy and good-humored interest in the proceedings was now changed to a strained watchfulness. Mascal and the Nightspore took the places allotted to them. Mrs. Trent kept stealing uneasy glances at them. Throughout the entire incident, Mozart's hymn continued to be played. The orchestra also had heard nothing. Backhouse now entered on his task. It was one that began to be familiar to him, and he had no anxiety about the result. It was not possible to affect the materialization by mere concentration of will or the exercise of any faculty. Otherwise, many people could have done what he had engaged himself to do. His nature was phenomenal. The dividing wall between himself and the spiritual world was broken in many places. Through the gaps in his mind, the inhabitants of the invisible, when he summoned them, passed for a moment timidly and awfully into the solid, colored universe. He could not say how it was brought about. The experience was a rough one for the body, and many such struggles would lead to insanity and early death. This is why Backhouse was stern and abrupt in his manner. The coarse, clumsy suspicion of some of the witnesses, the frivolous aestheticism of others, were equally obnoxious to his grim, bursting heart. But he was obliged to live and to pay his way. Must put up with these impertinences. He sat down facing the wooden couch. His eyes remained open but seemed to look inward. His cheeks paled and he became noticeably thinner. The spectators almost forgot to breathe. The more sensitive among them began to feel or imagine strange presences all around them. And Mascal's eyes glittered with anticipation, and his brows went up and down, but Nightspore appeared bored. After a long 10 minutes, the pedestal of the statue was seen to become slightly blurred, as though an intervening mist was rising from the ground. This slowly developed into a visible cloud, coiling hither and thither, and constantly changing shape. The professor half rose and held his glasses with one hand further forward on the bridge of his nose. By slow stages, the cloud acquired the dimensions and approximate outline of an adult human body, although all was still vague and blurred. It hovered lightly in the air, a foot or so above the couch. Backhouse looked haggard and ghastly. Mrs. Jameson quietly fainted in her chair, but she was unnoticed and presently revived. The apparition now settled down upon the couch, and at the moment of doing so seemed suddenly to grow dark, solid, and manlike. Many of the guests were as pale as the medium himself, but Fall preserved his stoical apathy and glanced once or twice at Mrs. Trent. She was staring straight at the couch and was twisting a little lace handkerchief through the different fingers of her hand. The music went on playing. The figure was by this time unmistakably that of a man lying down. The face focused itself into distinctness. The body was draped in a sort of shroud, but the features were those of a young man. One smooth hand fell over, nearly touching the floor, white and motionless. The weaker spirits of the company stared at the vision in sick horror. The rest were grave and perplexed. The seeming man was dead, but somehow it did not appear like a death succeeding life, but like death preliminary to life. All felt that he might sit up at any minute. "Stop that music," muttered Backhouse, tottering from his chair, facing the party. Fall touched the bell. A few more bars sounded, and then total silence ensued. "Anyone who wants to may approach the couch," said Backhouse with difficulty. Lang at once advanced and stared awestruck at the supernatural youth. "You are at liberty to touch," said the medium. But Lang did not venture to, nor did any of the others, who one by one stole up to the couch until it came to be Fall's turn. He looked straight at Mrs. Trent, who seemed frightened and disgusted at the spectacle before her, and then not only touched the apparition, but suddenly grasped the drooping hand in his own and gave it a powerful squeeze. Mrs. Trent gave a low scream. The ghostly visitor opened his eyes and looked at Fall strangely and sat up on the couch. A cryptic smile started playing over his mouth. Fall looked at his hand. A feeling of intense pleasure passed through his body. Mascal caught Mrs. Jameson in his arms. She was attacked by another spell of faintness. Mrs. Trent ran forward and led her out of the room. Neither of them returned. The phantom body now stood upright, looking about him, still with his peculiar smile. Pryor suddenly felt sick and went out. The other men more or less hung together for the sake of human society, but Nightspore paced up and down like a man weary and impatient, while Mascal attempted to interrogate the youth. The apparition watched him with a baffling expression, but did not answer. Backhouse was sitting apart, his face buried in his hands. It was at this moment that the door was burst open violently, and a stranger, unannounced, half leaped, half strode a few yards into the room and then stopped. None of Fall's friends had ever seen him before. He was a thick, shortish man with surprising muscular development and a head far too large in proportion to his body. His beardless, yellow face indicated, as a first impression, a mixture of sagacity, brutality, and humor. "Ah, gentlemen," he called out loudly. His voice was piercing and oddly disagreeable to the ear. "So we have a little visitor here." Nightspore turned his back, but everyone else stared at the intruder in astonishment. He took another few steps forward, which brought him to the edge of the theater. "May I ask, sir, how I come to have the honor of being your host?" asked Fall sullenly. He thought that the evening was not proceeding as smoothly as he had anticipated. The newcomer looked at him for a second, and then broke into a great roaring guffaw. He thumped Fall on the back playfully, but the play was rather rough, for the victim was sent staggering against the wall before he could recover his balance. "Good evening, my host!" "And good evening to you, my lad," he went on, addressing the supernatural youth, who was now beginning to wander around the room in apparent unconsciousness of his surroundings. "I have seen someone very much like you before, I think." "We have discussed that, haven't we, Mascal?" There was no response beyond. The intruder thrust his head almost up to the phantom's face. "You have no right to be here, as you know." The shape looked back at him with a smile full of significance, which, however, no one could understand. "Be careful what you're doing," said Backhouse quickly. "What's the matter, Spirit Usher?" "I don't know who you are, but if you use physical violence towards that, as you seem inclined to do, the consequences may prove very unpleasant. And without pleasure, our evening would be spoiled, wouldn't it, my little mercenary friend?" Humor vanished from his face like sunlight from a landscape, leaving it hard and rocky. Before anyone realized what he was doing, he encircled the soft, white neck of the materialized shape with his hairy hands and, with a double turn, twisted it completely around. A faint, unearthly shriek sounded, and the body fell in a heap to the floor. Its face was uppermost. The guests were unutterably shocked to observe that its expression had changed from the mysterious but fascinating smile to a vulgar, sordid, bestial grin, which cast a cold shadow of moral nastiness into every heart. The transformation was accompanied by a sickening stench of the graveyard. The features faded rapidly, the body lost its consistency, and passing from the solid to the shadowy condition before 2 minutes had elapsed, and the spirit form had entirely disappeared. The short stranger turned and confronted the party with a long, loud laugh. It was like nothing in nature. The professor talked excitedly to Kent Smith in low tones. Fall beckoned Backhouse behind a wing of scenery and handed him his check without a word. The medium put it in his pocket, buttoned his coat, and walked out of the room. Lang followed him in order to get a drink. The stranger poked his face up into Mascal's. "Well, giant, what do you think of that all? Wouldn't you like to see the land where this sort of fruit grows wild?" "What sort of fruit?" "That specimen goblin." Mascal waved him away with his huge hand. "Who are you? How did you come here?" "Call up your friend. Perhaps he may recognize me." Nightspore had moved a chair to the fire and was watching the embers with a set, fanatical expression. Let Crag come to me if he wants me, he said in his strange voice. You see, he does know me, uttered Crag with a humorous look. Walking over to Nightspore, he put a hand on the back of his chair. Still the same old gnawing hunger. What is he doing these days? Demanded Nightspore disdainfully, without altering his attitude. Surtur has gone, and we are all to follow him. How do you two come to know each other, and of whom are you speaking? Asked Maskall, looking from one to the other in perplexity. Crag has something for us. Let us go outside, replied Nightspore. He got up, glanced over his shoulder. Maskall, following the direction of his eye, observed that the few remaining men were watching their little group with great attentiveness. 2. In the street. The three men gathered in the street outside the house. The night was slightly frosty, with particularly clear east wind blowing. The multitude of blazing stars caused the sky to appear like a vast scroll of hieroglyphic symbols. Maskall felt oddly excited. He had a sense that something extraordinary was just about to happen. What brought you here to this house tonight, Crag? What made you do what you did? How are we to understand that apparition? That must have been Crystal Man's expression on its face, muttered Nightspore. We have discussed that, haven't we, Maskall? Maskall is anxious to behold that rare fruit in its native wilds. Maskall looked at Crag carefully, trying to analyze his own feelings towards him. He was distinctly repelled by the man's personality, yet side by side with his aversion, a savage, living energy seemed to spring up in his heart that in some strange fashion was attributable to Crag. Why do you insist on this simile? He asked. Because it is apropos. Nightspore is quite right. That was Crystal Man's face, and we are going to Crystal Man's country. Where is this mysterious country? Torments. That's a quaint name. Where is it? Crag grinned, showing his yellow teeth in the light of the street lamp. It is a residential suburb of Arcturus. What's he talking about, Nightspore? Do you mean the star of that name? He went on to Crag. Which you have in front of you at this very minute, said Crag, pointing a thick finger toward the brightest star in the southeastern sky. There you see Arcturus, and Torments is its one inhabited planet. Maskall looked at the heavy, gleaming star, and again at Crag. Then he pulled out a pipe and began to fill it. You must have cultivated a new form of humor, Crag. I'm glad I can amuse you, Maskall, if only for a few days. I meant to ask you, how do you know my name? It would be odd if I didn't, seeing that I only came here on your account. As a matter of fact, Nightspore and I are old friends. Maskell paused with his suspended match. You came here on my account? Surely, on your account and Nightspore's. We three are to be fellow travelers. Maskell now lit his pipe and puffed away coolly for a few moments. I'm sorry, Crag, but I must assume you are mad. Crag threw his head back and gave its scraping laugh. Am I mad, Nightspore? Has Surtur gone to torments? Ejaculated Nightspore in a strangled voice, fixing his eyes on Crag's face. Yes, and he requires that we follow him at once. Maskull's heart began to beat strangely. It all sounded to him like a dream conversation. And since how long, Crag, have I been required to do things by a total stranger? Besides, who is this individual? Crag's chief, said Nightspore, turning his head away. The riddle is too elaborate for me. I give up. You're looking for mysteries, said Crag, so naturally you're finding them. Try and simplify your ideas, my friend. The affair is quite plain and serious. Maskell stared hard at him and smoked rapidly. Where have you come from now? Demanded Nightspore suddenly. From the old observatory at Starkness. Have you heard of the famous Starkness Observatory, Maskell? No. Where is it? On the northeast coast of Scotland. Curious discoveries are made there. From time to time. For example, how to make voyages to the stars. So this Surtur turns out to be an astronomer, and you too, presumably. Crag grinned again. How long will it take you to wind up your affairs? When can be ready to start? You are too considerate, said Maskell, laughing outright. I was beginning to fear that I would be hauled away at once. However, I have neither wife, nor land, nor profession. So there's nothing to wait for. What is the itinerary? You are a fortunate man, a bold, daring heart, and no encumbrances. Crag's features became suddenly grave and rigid. But don't be a fool and refuse a gift of luck. A gift declined is not offered a second time. Crag, replied Maskell simply, returning his pipe to his pocket. I ask you to put yourself in my place. Even if I were a sick man for adventures, how could I listen seriously to such an insane proposition as this? What do I know about you? What do I know about your past record? You may be a practical joker. You may have come out of a madhouse. I don't know anything about it. If you claim to be an exceptional man and want my cooperation, you must offer me exceptional proof. And what proof would you consider adequate, Maskell? As he spoke, he gripped Maskell's arm. A sharp, chilling pain immediately passed through the latter's body, and at the same moment, his brain caught fire. A light burst in upon him like the rising of the sun. He asked himself for the first time if this fantastic conversation could by any chance refer to real things. Listen, Crag, he said slowly, while peculiar images and conceptions started to travel in rich disorder through his mind. You talk about a certain journey. Well, if that journey were a possible one, if I were to give you the chance of making it, I would be willing never to come back. For 24 hours on that Arcturian planet, I would give my life. That is my attitude towards that journey. Now prove to me that you're not talking nonsense. Produce your credentials. And that was part one of David Lindsay's 1920 surrealist fantasy adventure, A Voyage to Arcturus. We'll be back next Friday, 11 p.m., for part two of the novel. Stay tuned for more great programming on your listener-sponsored WORT, and I'll see you next week. And you're tuned to WORT 89.9 FM, right here in Madison, Wisconsin.
Thank you. fienno e fuori se vi aggiunge a po' di sale.
Poverta, batti alla porta.
Get ready for Wartstock on Sunday, May 18th in Warner Park. We have a great lineup of music this year. Bluegrass from Annie and the Okies starts the show at noon. Cuban Conjunto from Revolu will get you up and dancing. The Dirk Quinn Band kicks up a jazz fusion jam from Philadelphia, sponsored by Bluestem Jazz. Smart Cookie is up next with Smooth Groove Pop, and headlining the show is Stephen Cooper and the Nobody Famous, featuring the vocal powerhouse Katrina DeVille and a 10-piece band blasting scorching rhythm and blues. Madison Homebrewers will be back with the 21st annual No Crap on Tap, a rotating selection of beers, ciders, and seltzers from more than 20 local breweries. There will be a delicious array of food vendors to satisfy any craving, and local artisans with beautiful items to browse and buy. Nonprofit tablers will have information on getting involved in the community, and the art exploration area will nourish your creative side. The prize raffle offers concert tickets, hotel stays, merch, and more. Wartstock is proudly sponsored by Summit Credit Union, MG&E Foundation, Dane Arts, Harmony Bar, Madison Homebrewers and Tasters Guild, WSUM, Hoyos Consulting, and Bluestem Jazz. See you there!
Yeah, we'll see you there. Hey, everybody, this is Half Tongue here. This is the